Wrote some easy ones.
But I'm not sure if there are any easy ones here. So, okay, so the first one, I'm just going to go through them here. First one, is it feasible to organize a day where those of us who wish can donate one day's food or the money to buy it to the neighboring community? There's been a fair amount of talk about loving kindness and compassion, and there's been the loving kindness sittings at the end of the day, and so on. And sometimes, in a retreat situation like this, it's very difficult to see any application. It just seems like lots of talk and very little action. And this question may be reflecting that feeling. We've been doing retreats here in the Thai temple, I think, since 1976. And I was fortunate enough actually to be here in 1976 for the first retreat. And those retreats in the late 70s, we used to do a thing on the day between the two retreats, on the break. We would organize the preparation of lunch for all the beggars in town. And it was much easier in those days because Bodh Gaya was a much, much smaller village and there was only maybe 25 or 30 beggars here. It would be a little bit more difficult now. But it always generated very good feeling, very warm feeling for everyone to prepare these huge buckets of rice and dal and go out, and the beggars would come and sit in rows and we would go down and spoon it out, and the little children would then mob us and be grabbing and clawing, scrambling for more. But anyway, we used to do that. And 2 years ago, Christopher organized in the break between the two 10-day retreats, we went out and did some cleaning up around along the riverfront. I know a few of you were here 2 years ago, and there was a lot of cleaning up to do 2 years ago. It was a very big year. There were, I think, 250,000 Tibetans here for an initiation that the Dalai Lama was giving. So not to start any future planning now, but perhaps in the break between the 2 days, between the two 10-day retreats, some of us could get together and maybe someone could come up with an idea for something that we can do along that line. Okay, so maybe on the last day of this retreat we can think about that a little bit.
May I ask something direct to this point, please?
Okay, one question. We've got a lot of questions here to go through.
If you go in the temple, there are every morning very poor children. They don't have anything to
eat. Okay, we can talk about that at the end of the retreat, okay?
And I have a suggestion, we could make something with it.
Yeah, you could present that as a suggestion on the last day of the retreat, along with suggestions other.
Why?
Yes.
Because
we can't do anything about it right now. Next question. For a foreign speaking participant, this doesn't only apply to foreign-speaking participants. For a foreign-speaking participant, could explain differences, if any, between mindfulness and awareness. I don't think it's only foreign-speaking participants who don't see any difference here. These two terms very frequently are used interchangeably, and the way I use them myself, I would say most of the time they're interchangeable. Mindfulness, awareness, no difference at all. They may be used in a slightly different way, though. The term mindfulness can be used in the sense of having something in mind, so having an object in mind. So being mindful of the breath, or being mindful of talking into a microphone, or being mindful of sitting in front of a crowd of people trying to reply to these questions, or being mindful of eating, or mindful of walking, or whatever. So there's an object being held in mind. Whereas awareness can be seen as more of just a very settled-in thing, a very relaxed thing, something that's just happening naturally, so there's no holding. The awareness is just there. There's just being aware of walking or just being aware of sitting, and there's no effort being made. There's no attempt to hold on to that. If people have questions, maybe they could ask them later. Perhaps people could, if you have questions, you could ask either in the small groups or you could come and see me individually after. As I mentioned at the beginning, my responses may or may not be what you're looking for or what your ideas are. They're just my opinions and the ideas that come to my mind just as I'm sitting right here. And by the way, this is the first time I've ever sat in front of such a big group and answered questions like this. So any whatever answer I give, however brilliant or stupid it may be, there's going to be, well, I think there's 110 people here, so there's probably going to be 110 other possible responses. So, okay, so if you could just all keep that in mind. What is the relationship between creativity and the wanting mind? It seems to me that, to put it very briefly, to show the difference very briefly or very concisely, the wanting mind is taking in or attempting to take in, and the creative mind is giving out. So with the wanting mind, there's wanting to accumulate, there's wanting to get something, wanting to achieve something, wanting to attain something. And with the creative mind, there's more of an outflow, just allowing to flow out without so much of this sense of trying to achieve something or trying to get something or trying to attain something or trying to create something. The creativity is just the natural outflow of one's being, of what is. And that can manifest in different ways. So some people are creative in speaking. Some people are creative in writing. Some are creative in drawing or painting. Some are creative in arranging flowers. Some are creative in giving Dharma talks, different forms of creativity, and all just the outflow of one's natural being and a natural expression of one's being. Could you please discuss briefly the motivation which initially inspired you to take robes when you did? Me? And also the reasons why you handed back your vows. It's for Christopher. Yeah, I guess that. I've never taken robes myself. Although I have spent time in a monastery at Wat Swan Mok in Thailand, where quite a few of you here have also stayed. So I can't really say what... the reasons why you handed back your vows. Maybe I could just make a few comments on vows. Vows is something that I think a lot of us, or maybe all of us, think about from time to time, taking vows. And... In many traditions, even in the West now, when we come to do a Vipassana retreat, at the beginning of the retreat we take precepts, which are vows, and often the way it's presented is we're taking these vows for this 10-day period or this 5-day period or 7-day period or whatever it is, and then at the end of that period, then we're free to choose whether we keep these vows or so-called hand them back.
Okay.
I like to think of vows. There's also a lot of confusion about vows. A person takes a vow or takes a precept, and then a situation comes up where it doesn't really seem to fit. And doubt can come into the mind. Should I have taken this vow, or should I break it now, or what's going to happen if I break it? And a lot of doubt and confusion can come up. The way I like to look at vows is they can be seen as another technique. The Rinpoche yesterday talked about using the techniques, like cooking the meal, and you use the technique, but you come to the point where you have to drop the technique. You have to eat the food and taste what you've been cooking. And maybe vows could be looked at in the same way, so they can be taken on as a tool or as an aid, as a technique. But perhaps the time will come when the vow, the technique, is dropped and the food is tasted. And that's not to say that the vow is disregarded and that you're free to do anything against it. Is to say that perhaps having used the technique, the fruit of that can then be enjoyed. The meal can be eaten. Overcome anger, hatred with compassion. How is this actually, underlined with arrows pointing to it, practically done? In a crowded bus where a man takes the advantage to rub his leg on mine, on top of the hot, crowded, and tiring situation. It seems it seems to be a problem, particularly in India, for women. I'm assuming this is written by a woman, and there does seem to be a problem in India with men taking advantages in crowded situations. It happens in the West too, by the way. There's quite often reports in Toronto on the subways. There's quite often in the newspapers. You quite often see in the court section where people are in court charged with assault on the subway, and often it's been from assaulting a woman. Quite a serious problem. Anyway, overcome anger, hatred with compassion. How is this actually practically done? I wonder if the overcoming of anger and hatred has to mean elimination of anger and hatred. And I wonder if having compassion has to mean that we disregard, or that we don't respond, or that we don't do anything about it. I wonder if a man takes the advantage to rub his leg on mine in a bus, I wonder if it's possible to slap him with compassion. I wonder if it's possible. Well, it's being done quite often now in Delhi. They have the term for this in India, by the way, is Eve teasing. Probably a lot of you know this, and there's laws against Eve teasing, and Eve, as in Adam and Eve teasing, And what's happening more and more frequently in Delhi is that when this happens, the woman who is assaulted immediately gets up and screams, and all the other women on the bus will get up and they will force the driver to immediately drive to the nearest police station. And I read of one case where the bus driver refused to do it, and the women grabbed him and took off his clothes and threw him out of the street. So I wonder if it's possible to take appropriate action with compassion. What, if any, are the advantages of doing a Vipassana retreat in a group situation? If I were to do a retreat alone, how should I go about it? The many advantages of doing in a group. First of all, just the organizational aspect. If it's a group, it's much easier to arrange things like cooks and places to do the retreat and things like that. So generally, there's much less to do, so much more time can be devoted to the sitting and the walking. Not that that's any more important than cooking and house cleaning and things. But anyway, it seems to make things a little bit easier. The main advantage that I experience is a group energy that builds up. Even with the silence, so many people working together and being together and supporting each other and knowing that that other people are going through the same things, the same difficulties, the same good times, the same hard times. And knowing that we're all in this together, and we're all working at this together, and we're all part of something together. And this group energy, this group support, is very helpful. It makes it much more easy to stay with what's happening. And similarly, outside of a formal retreat situation, very commonly people say that, well, in the retreat it's fine because I have all this support, but when I go out I'm all alone and it's so difficult to continue practice, so we end up having to go to more retreats and more retreats and more retreats, and in between retreats somehow we forget. So outside of retreats also, the group, the contact with people with similar interests, the sangha, is very helpful, and it's because of this support and this energy that builds up and helping one another. To do a retreat alone, how should I go about it? Basically, exactly the same. There's no difference. Find a place, arrange food, sit and walk, sit and walk, sit and walk. I think some more will be said about this on the last day of the retreat. The reason I'm going over some of these is because they're sort of related to some of the questions that have already been answered. Who or what is the devil or the evil or the opposite of the great energy or God according to the Buddhist tradition? I'm not an authority on the Buddhist tradition, so I'm not really sure exactly what to say. My understanding of the Buddhist tradition, though, is that there is no concept of God, so I don't think there is any concept of devil as the opposite of God. I just read an interesting quote I can't even remember where I read it. Just in the last few days I read a quote that from someone that evil isn't the opposite of goodness. Evil has nothing to do with goodness. And that really struck me as a very, quite a different way and quite a helpful way of looking at good and evil. And beyond that, though, I think we have to look at what our beliefs are and what our conditions are that cause us to think of some things as good and some things as evil. And how is it that we come to seeing some things as good and some as evil, or some as bad and some as, and seeing them as opposites? And I wonder if we should look at if there's such extremes, or is it that things have some good and some evil, or sometimes something is good and sometimes something is evil, rather than fixing it as this is good and this is evil. And see, and be open to each situation and to each situation as it arises, and see how is it in this moment, how is it right now. What's all this touchy-feeling? What's all this touchy-feely togetherness about? It leaves me cold. Aren't we here to meditate? Touchy-feely togetherness. Maybe I'm sitting on the wrong side. I often wonder when I close my eyes, what's going on out there? Up here it just seems to be the mosquitoes that are doing the touching and feeling. I don't see any difference or any separation between touching and feeling and togetherness where it is happening. I don't see any difference between that and meditating. I don't see how touchy-feely togetherness interferes with meditating. If we are having touchy-feeling togetherness, then for me that would be part of the meditation. This is the one that Christopher already answered about the teachers and managers talking and laughing loudly in the kitchen. Does anyone know anything? Answer. No. Then should we follow anyone or anything apart from ourselves and instinct? Seems the question's already answered. I think we should follow ourselves in the sense of being aware of our own inner wisdom and having trust in our own inner wisdom and trust in our own instincts and trust in our own understanding and trust that when we really look at something right here and now and we're really with something, that each one of us will know what is the answer in that moment. And to be aware of the answer in that moment. And in that moment of awareness and that moment of seeing, then we know everything. It's also important not to fix that. The knowing in that moment, not to fix that and assume that that knowing will apply to the next moment or to any other moment. And to really be aware of each moment, this present moment right now. And in this moment, we can know everything. Could you explain something about the energy centers, chakras, nadis, directions, and flows, etc.? And maybe the difference between Buddhist and Hindu yoga systems. Also, could you explain the meaning of Om Namah Shivaya and Alleluia? The difference between Buddhist and Hindu yoga systems, I don't know very much about Hindu yoga systems, and don't know very much about Buddhist yoga systems either. Something about the energy centers, chakras, nadis, directions and flows, etc. In some of the Hindu systems, and I think in some of the in some of the Buddhist systems also, there's from the little I know, there's much more emphasis put on the idea of energy flows in the body, particularly up the spine, and there's reference to particular centers along this. And these centers are called chakras or nadis. And the idea or the aim of the meditation is to release the energy in the chakras. In this particular approach, we're not so concerned with trying to isolate or identify particular points which may or may not exist. In the process of examining ourselves, examining the mind, examining the body, examining thoughts, examining everything about ourselves, sometimes we come in touch with these energy centers and these energy flows, and we get a sense that there may be something there. And it seems to me that by starting out with the idea that these are there and we have to do something with them, very easily there can be such a fixation on that we miss seeing everything. And my own preference is just to look and see what is there rather than to look for something or try to do something with something that may be there. So just look and see what's taking place right now. Is there a blockage of energy? Is there some energy to be released somewhere? Is there a flow of energy? Is there a stagnation of energy? Just to look and see what is taking place. And in the seeing and in coming to some understanding, allowing for things to take place as they take place. I have a particular interest in the whole idea of energy centers and energy flows. I work as a shiatsu therapist, so I'm working very much with energy flows. And for some people, a very intense sensitivity to energy flows can arise. And some people can look at someone and actually see where the energy is moving and where the energy is blocked. And other people can't. But whatever, if we just look and see and get more and more in touch with our own energy and our own being, and then we can see where these may or may not be. What do you mean by faith in yourself? Often it may be taken to mean faith in the personality and individuality, which in turn is basis for all ego and thus totally against living unconditioned. Faith in yourself, faith in the personality of the individual. This is assuming a separation or a difference between oneself and others. If that assumption isn't made, if the assumption that this personality and individual is different or separate or not in any way conditioned by or conditional on these other so-called personalities and individuals, then faith in oneself is faith more in just in the way things are. Faith in the being, in life as it is, exactly as it is in this moment. And so faith in oneself, I don't think, has to be the basis for ego. And I'm not sure if faith in oneself is totally against living unconditioned. If that assumption that somehow oneself is separate from everyone else isn't being made. Pleasure and pain, happiness and unhappiness, are sensations which come and go. Why do you say at the end of the sitting, may all beings be happy? Be happy with your pain. Be happy with your unhappiness. Be happy with your pleasure. And be happy with your happiness. This one refers to something that Christopher said, so I can't answer that. Do you see any value in using drugs like hash, ganja, organic psychedelics? This is, I view this, I think of a question like this as an attempt at a trick question. It's one of those questions that's hard to say no to, but hard to say yes to also. It's hard to say no to because I know of many people who have had apparently from using drugs. I say apparently because I'm not sure if there's any way of definitely attributing it to the drugs, but I know of many people who have apparently had some experience from the use of drugs which has brought them to a deeper inquiry into life and a deeper understanding of life and a deeper understanding of themselves. And because of that, I find it difficult to say no to this question. However, I also see many dangers with the use of drugs. And well, I'm sure you're all aware of the dangers: addiction, physical injury, mental injury, just a whole range. And the other thing is that even though these experiences may be very powerful and have very strong impact and may lead or apparently lead the person to something much deeper, which is not dependent on drugs, I would say that there is also the potential for coming to these understandings without the use of drugs and therefore without any of the dangers involved in using the drugs. And I would also say that any of the understandings that come about from my experience and also from talking to people and talking to people who have used drugs and people who have meditated and people who are very aware, the understandings which come about apparently from the use of drugs in terms of depth and impact is nothing compared to what's possible through simply being present in the moment with the mind totally unclouded or unaltered by any external substance. What to do about persistent, crude, but juicy sexual fantasies? Seeing the body as a sack of shit, bag of bones, etc. seems to be of no use. This is quite a common thing that comes up for people. during retreats, the sexual fantasies. I guess the juiciness varies from one person to another. But sexual fantasies do come up quite commonly. One way of working with this is to see one's own body and the other body as a sack of shit and a bag of bones, as the Rinpoche mentioned yesterday. However, for some people, it's just not possible to see the body like this. Another way of working with it is simply to see that these are just fantasies. These sexual fantasies are just fantasies. And just watch it and be with it and allow it to be there and not try to deny it, not try to condemn it, but just allow it to be there. Another way to work with it possibly would be to go right to the heart of the matter. So when the fantasies are arising, take the energy right to the genital area, to the sexual area. Take the attention there and really experience what's going on. What's the physical sensations? What's happening with the energy? And be with that and really watch and see if it changes. See if it's persistent. See how it's affecting oneself. And the attention, and if it gets very intense, the attention can be spread out to disperse it somewhat. And just really be with the physical feelings and really allow it to be there and allow oneself to have these physical feelings. And just see that it's just a physical, it's just a sensation, it's just a fantasy of the mind, it's just a creation. And it comes up at times and it goes away at times, and it doesn't come up at times and it doesn't go away at times, just like anything else. Is a meditating stockbroker a contradiction in terms? Also, may we have the hot fudge vanilla and chocolate nut sundae this evening instead of tomorrow. I wish. I don't think a meditating stockbroker is a contradiction in terms, necessarily. It seems that the issue here is what's referred to as right livelihood. And in looking at livelihood, in looking at what we do, which in this case is being a stockbroker, I think it's important to look at our motivation, look at why we're doing it. And look at what the effects of what we're doing are on other people and on ourselves. And what's our relationship to our job? Are we satisfied with it? Are we dissatisfied with it? Are we exploiting others? Are we exploiting ourselves? Are we being exploited in our work? Are we doing our work in order to accumulate things? Are we doing our work in order to help others? Are we doing it in order to help ourselves? Are we using our work in a creative way? So the whole area of motivation is really important. And whether it's a contradiction in terms or not depends very much on our own answers to these questions and a lot of other questions. And if our own answers to these questions indicate that there is a contradiction, then we may have to look into changing our occupation or looking for other ways of viewing our occupation. So whether or not it's a contradiction in terms depends totally on our own evaluation, our own sense, our own inner feeling of what is this. And again, this comes back to the issue of personal trust, of just having that trust that if we really look and really examine ourselves, we'll be able to understand for ourselves whether or not it's a contradiction. And we'll be able to understand for ourselves what's the appropriate action, if any. Okay. So, time now for what? For walking? And group? Okay, and group. So, I hope I haven't answered any of your questions. Thank you.